What I'm going to do right now, I'm going to program your minds. I'm going to make you think of something. I'm going to make you think of something. And Wrestler Supreme, I decided, check your calendars, your dates, whatever it may be, I am never going to lose a match. Never.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 115 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, I'm going to be taking a look at a show that I've never looked at before from a technical standpoint, as this continues the brief Beertreon series that I've had. As I mentioned a few shows ago, I owed Richard Land, the head of one of the five families of wrestling footage, a show. And he has chosen the Superstars of Wrestling from May 31st, 1986. And I kind of say that with a chuckle because this is the D show of that time period behind Championship Wrestling, All-Star Wrestling, All-American Wrestling. And then here is the Superstars of Wrestling, which shares the same name as the show that would become the A show about 3 or 4 months after this one airs. So it is a little confusing. Eventually, it would turn into Wrestling Spotlight. So if you wanted something of an equivalent for it, and I've done episodes of Wrestling Spotlight in the past, probably about every 40 shows, so I think I'm more or less due for it now. So good timing on all of that. But let me get in my plugs real quick. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And I've been tweeting a lot about stuff that I've been watching leading up to this show, which I'll get to in a second. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. More on Pro Wrestling Only, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and all you can find there in just a little bit. I also would like to plug, even though this was the middle of last week, from the Place to Be Nation Pop feed, the one-off special that I was a participant on celebrating the television series Veep as it reached its final episode this past Sunday night, which that was a rather interesting part of my weekend in terms of that because of Game of Thrones. And I talk about this during the podcast and how when once Game of Thrones came on the air, it pushed Veep back out of its 10:30 time slot, which kind of screws up my sleeping schedule. Well, this was an extended episode of Veep, 50 minutes starting at 10:50. So it wasn't going to end until 11:40. So I drank quite a bit of iced coffee after 8:30 p.m. on Sunday night. Probably about 45 ounces worth, just my estimate. And I decided, you know what, to kind of balance it out, I'm going to pour a little bit of Black Velvet Canadian whiskey on there. And I'm here to tell you right now, kids, don't drink a lot of iced coffee after 8:30 and put black whiskey or Black Velvet Canadian whiskey in there, because you're basically going to lie in bed at 12 o'clock and be like Bart Simpson when he has the all syrup squishy. That's pretty much how it went down. I had trouble falling asleep. I'm sure that the alcohol component of it really didn't help. Also, I was excited from hockey earlier in the day, Game 2 of the Eastern Conference Finals here in Boston, where we're no longer distracted by the pesky Celtics sharing the TD Garden with the Bruins. But Veep was very good on Sunday night. Note, you're not going to get any spoilers from me, other than to say I hope that Tony Hale, character Gary, I hope Tony Hale gets an Emmy for his performance in that episode, particularly the last time we see him on screen. And also because it's May, felt like it was a good time to set up the garden at the side of my house. A TD Garden actually reminded me of that I should probably set up the garden with my wife where we planted lettuce, which hopefully the three rabbits that now hang around in my backyard, hopefully they don't get to it. So I put down the repellent that I'm pretty sure doesn't work because I started putting it down when there was one rabbit, and now there are three rabbits. And there's going to be five rabbits soon, and I'm going to have to either invest in a BB gun or I'm going to have to just smoke a joint out there and not worry about it at all. So, I don't know. Not a whole lot going on here because I'm enjoying some World Wrestling Federation action from 1986. And I've spoken at length at times about the TV from this time period between when they revamp it, and I've talked about that a lot, where September of 1986, Championship Wrestling becomes Superstars of Wrestling, All-Star becomes Wrestling Challenge, and everything is changing, in part because of everything kind of getting kicked along by the production values they learned from doing Saturday Night's Main Event. But here in the middle of 1986, because at WrestleMania II, you lose Piper for a while. He doesn't return for 4 months. Jesse Ventura leaves. He doesn't return until September. A bunch of other guys take time off. So it's kind of a little bit of a different promotion. So what they start doing with the TV during this time is they start throwing things against the wall and see what sticks. One of them is Jesse Ventura was one of the hosts of Primetime Wrestling. Well, with him no longer there, who are you going to pair up with Gorilla Monsoon, who took over the role from Jack Reynolds the previous year? So it's Heenan, Bobby the Brain Heenan, taking over on April 28th. And the chemistry between those two, and that's where they start the Primetime Wrestlings on the award-winning WWE Network, although apparently they're changing some of it, taking it off certain devices. I think that that's there are going to be people who cancel their subscriptions over that, and I think that they're going to be surprised at the numbers. So anyway, if you watch the Primetime Wrestlings from the spring and summer of 1986, it takes a little while for the Bobby Heenan, Gorilla Monsoon chemistry to kind of come to the forefront, because they did not do matches together. They actually did a match on this show, interestingly enough, where Heenan is filling in, which you see a lot of because of Jesse not being there, so he's no longer on All-Star. All-Star Wrestling became this incredible hodgepodge of commentators where you got Don Morocco, you got Jimmy Hart, like basically anybody who was around that they wanted to do commentary would just kind of jump in, and that show is all over the place, but it's God forbid we have any of the All-Stars from that period on the network. It's only, you know, the 70s up to about 1981. The other show that Warren's mentioning, which actually ended in the late summer, early fall of 1986, is TNT, which is funny that it's that name because it hadn't aired on Tuesday in a very long time. You get to around the time that this airs in late May is when the transition occurs from Vince McMahon to Gene Okerlund. And I had been tweeting out some observations of the episodes that I had been viewing. And some of it is actually not bad. You think of it as, oh, well, Vince has given up on the show. I mean, he hasn't totally given up. I mean, he's overseeing everything. But, oh, he hands it off, so now he just, you know, he doesn't really care about it as much. But there are certain things, like Mean Gene, the first one that he hosts, he's on there, and then Vince randomly comes back for an episode, and then Gene comes back after that. The one that Vince comes back for is the Mating Game one with the Hart Foundation and Jimmy Hart, which I think Richard posted a clip from that, and Natty Neidhart replied, said she didn't know about it. And I was thinking, you didn't know about your dad doing this great comedy skit? It's probably one of the best comedy things he ever did in his entire career. But, you know, some of the things that I point out, you know, if you're not following me on Twitter, I'm on cloud nine watching a 1986 TNT with Mean Gene talking Chernobyl with Nikolai Volkov. And yes, because Chernobyl had just happened in the Soviet Union, so it felt like a natural topic to bring up. The only way this could be better is if they let Mean Gene do a 5-minute Carson-style monologue. Now, when I covered the TNT show from August of 85, I was saying that it would be great if Vince had come out and done a monologue with Lord Al basically doing all the Ed McMahon mannerisms. Back to watching this morning, because I only have about a 40-minute window in the morning to actually watch these shows. Gene makes a not-too-subtle allusion to Paul Roma scoring some tail in Victoria, Australia. WWF had done a tour down under in the spring of 86, shortly after WrestleMania 2, I believe it was, and Paul Roma was one of the guys down there. They showed some video of him, Gene, SD Jones, who Roma had started teaming with around this time. Siviafi on TNT means it's time to take a piss and not hit pause. And yeah, sometimes TNT would have guests that were of virtually no interest to anybody, but fortunately for us, the show was only an hour long, and they generally kept those segments fairly short. It wasn't like he was out there for 10 minutes, although some segments became a little bit more infamous than others, including one that is going to air later on in this show. And then finally, Tony Atlas was on the program with Gene behind the desk. Gene asking Tony Atlas to take off his shirt like he's Gordon Jump running a bike shop. And yes, Different Strokes episode came to mind, because here's this bald white guy asking a person of color to take off their shirt. I mean, the comparison is totally there. So that's some examples of WWF television around this time. It's wacky, it's sometimes wonderful, sometimes really, really weird, like the Tuesday Night Titans appearance of Paul Christie, who said he was going to do magic, and I guess he never really got around to it, but we're going to see that coming up later on this episode of The Superstars of Wrestling. Just a couple more things about TNT. When Leapin' Lanny Poffo was on there, they had said that he was training like a savage. Now, come on, why would you use that word unless you were trying to convey some special coded message to the audience? And Bobby Heenan, whenever he would appear on there, that was always a treat, the little back and forth. But, I'm not actually doing this show on TNT. It's just that that's the one that happens to be on the network, so I was going to watch it because there's been a recent YouTube purge, so some of the episodes from 86 are no longer on there. But I think the TNTs do give a pretty good perspective of where everything was at that point. We do have a debut on this program. It is actually not the first time he wrestled on television, but it is the tape of the first match of Harley Race in this particular WWF run. He did defend the NWA title there in 1980 against Bob Backlund at MSG in the summertime, but he is wrestling SD Jones up at Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto. We're also going to see Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, who has just gotten into his feud with Jake the Snake Roberts. I managed to watch that Saturday Night's Main Event from May of 1986 as well. Another fascinating show from Providence, Rhode Island, Uncle Elmer versus King Kong Bundy, where thankfully Elmer is put out to pasture once and for all. In fact, I don't think he ever wrestled again after that. But most famously, late in the show, it was much later in the program than I remembered it being, the supposed to be a match between Roberts and Steamboat, and Steamboat just kind of gets decked when he's on the apron, DDT'd on the cement floor, dragged into the ring, and had the snake thrown on him. Certainly the highest profile guy that was done to during Jake's heel run after he had come in, so the first year that he is in the WWF. Also on this show, we have a women's match, which was not something you would see very often on TV. Maybe once every other month. Maybe they'd shove it to the C or D show, but we got Judy Martin taking on Candice Perdue, who also had a very interesting appearance on TNT, but much earlier in 1986 than this. And we're going to see in tag team action the U.S. Express, the American Express, however you want to call them, but it is not Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo. It is the Golden Boy, Dan Spivey, and Mike Rotundo, who was making his return in that match. So enough introduction of this, because this particular video has original commercials from 1986. So I'm going to have to provide a little bit of commentary for all of them. And because you probably got about 24 ads, maybe a few repeats, I'm going to need to save time for that. So with that in mind, I'm going to jump into the show. This is episode 115, nearing the end of my sports series. It's, I guess, only four more to go after this one before I hit 2019, and I can't do anything at 120. I guess I could play... Could I find a Babe Ruth home run from the radio from 1920? Had radio been invented? It was around that time. But in any event, let's kick it off with a sports moment from the year 2015.
Up the middle, gloved by Murphy. There's one, and they will not get the double play. Wow, did Chase Utley go in hard at second as the tying run scores. Tejada is down. The game is tied. And now we check on Tejada.
I had no skin in the game for that Dodgers-Mets NLDS back in 2015. I was rooting probably for the Mets, though, because it would make my friend Craig happy. And, you know, Mets fans have suffered so much over the years. But, of course, they suffer a little bit more there because Chase Utley, who I praised back in the 2008 episode, so episode 108 for his smart play at second base, you know, cutting down a man at the plate, forcing a guy into a bad base running mistake in the 2008 World Series. Yeah, that's just me cultivating my substantial Philadelphia audience and sucking up to them. Here, that was the dirtiest friggin' slide of all time, and it made me angry going back and watching it. Just because something was acceptable because Hal McRae did it in like 1977 does not mean in the year of our Lord 2015 you should be doing it. Things change. The guy slid when he was pretty much on the base anyway. It was for the express purpose of hurting the guy. And oh, by the way, they went to replay and they overturned the out. But thankfully, the Mets ended up winning that series because nothing against the Dodgers in particular. I love watching Clayton Kershaw pitch. But for God's sakes, I mean, Chase Utley, and then the following year, the Mets threw at him in a game. It might have been 2 years later. And that led to Noah Syndergaard being ejected from that game, Terry Collins. But also, the umpire for that game happened to be mic'd, so you were able to hear the whole argument. Hopefully, I remember to put that one. I can't remember if it was 2016 or 2017, but that was one of the all-time great arguments that's ever been captured on audio in all of baseball history. So it's a cold open before you get the Superstars of Wrestling theme song with Harley Race and SD Jones in Maple Leaf Gardens, where Heenan is cracking on SD's new wear from Antigua because he has moved there from Philadelphia. I guess kind of like the 1986 version of Tito Santana going back to his roots. Like, we're going to send SD back to the West Indies and he's going to kind of rediscover himself there. Hey, it got him an action figure out of the deal. And the theme song for the Superstars of Wrestling, it's a pretty cool one in my opinion. It's kind of like the sports intros that you'd see on like regional sports networks in the 80s, and I guess also on like an ESPN, but I'm thinking New England Sports Network, MSG Network, Philadelphia Spectrum. You'd see them even before like the WWF house shows that they would air on there. I mean, I've expressed my love for the WWF on NESN theme. It's one of the all-time great things. But we go right into the show in what I think they call Edit One. And our hosts are Vince McMahon and straight on Lord Alfred Hayes. Luckily, he's not in the three-quarters position looking all weird and extra fat like he did that episode several weeks ago. And the two of them, they actually make a subtle acknowledgement of Harley Race's past when bringing up him being new to the World Wrestling Federation. You know, no, of course not going to say that he was the NWA champion, although anybody who had been watching for more than 6 years would know that, even if they'd only watched WWF TV and had any sort of long-term memory. But what makes this intro great is not the... it's not the Harley Race stuff. Of course, it has to do with Lord Alfred Hayes being a little bit strange here as we get a brief glimpse at what I like to call Pervert Al.
There's one other thing I would like to add. Candice Perdue. I'd want to see how she figures too.
I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing to bring up since she's not a huge star and he just kind of brings the women's match out of nowhere. Maybe Al is the other side of that Lee Marshall coin from when Lee Marshall was the women's wrestling expert back in WCW days for whatever reason. So our first match is from a recent championship wrestling as we get the quote, newly formed team of the U.S. Express or the American Express, depends on, you know, how it's phrased at various points, is born in the USA, plays, as everybody just misunderstands the lyrics, Mike Rotundo making his return to the WWF alongside Danny Spivey, who they are not pretending is Barry Windham anymore at this point. That's something you can leave that in the rearview mirror. They are taking on Paul Christie and Steve Lombardi. Of course, Lombardi I've talked about many times. Christie, he's going to be on TNT a little bit later in a very extended clip. I have to mention this because Bruce Springsteen has a new album coming out, and it's based on like Songs of the Southwest, which has me very intrigued. For it's something new, it's something different, kind of Devils and Dust-ish. Please bear with me for a second, because the first single with Bruce from this album has recently come out. It's playing on E Street Radio, and I assume on commercial radio. I haven't listened to commercial radio in years. Is a song called Hello Sunshine. And when I heard that that was the name of the first single, I was so excited. I was like, yes, Bruce is watching 1983 World Class, and he is marking out for Sunshine and the feud with Precious and all that great stuff. Oh, I'm so happy that Bruce is finally tuning in to World Class on the network. That's what I'm sure that he's doing between those Broadway shows from back when. But anyway, Mike Rotundo, just kind of a quick timeline since he left and came back. He disappeared December of 1985. Windham, as I covered when I did the Saturday Night's Main Event from October of 85, that was the same month that he left the scene. But Rotundo, once Windham leaves, it's not like they threw Danny Spivey out there and pretended he was Windham at that point. He was tagging with Tony Atlas, Junkyard Dog, even Mr. Wrestling 2, which is one of those things where you generally don't think of him as being in the WWF, but he was there for much longer than you would remember in 85 and 86. Spivey does show up in November, and he used the Bulldog as his finisher. In that way, he is kind of cosplaying Barry Windham. Rotundo and Spivey, they do team on house shows, and I went back to, I think it was the December of 85 Boston Garden show. It may have been November of 85. And they refer to Spivey by name, so it's not like they're just leaving him nameless and saying, oh, I mean, Spivey comes to the ring with a jacket that has his last name on the back. He's announced to the crowd. The crowd is a lot more muted when it comes to him versus Rotundo, and the bloom is coming off the rose a little bit as well. This is actually the May 24th edition of Championship Wrestling, so this match is a week old. Now, Rotundo, when he disappears for a while, he goes to the AWA, goes down to Florida, which was kind of his home base for a long time, but he was mostly working tours in All Japan earlier in the year, similar to somebody that we're going to see coming up a little bit later. But one thing that's fascinating is in 85, he's referred to as Mike Rotundo, but now he is being referred to as Mike Rotunda, which means, and I'm referring to the Chiron on the screen. So I guess the change is happening for that there. The Rotunda thing always threw me for a friggin' loop back in the day. So Spivey and Lombardi start out. Lombardi gets arm dragged, and then Rotundo comes in. They continue working on the left arm as Vince and Bruno start talking about Steve Lombardi as perhaps the most improved wrestler of the WWF. I'm very confused by this line of thought.
Mike Rotundo in complete control at the moment over Lombardi. Well, I would think if there were some sort of award for most improved wrestler in the WWF, he might be in contention for that award. Lombardi's come a long way.
Rotundo?
No, Lombardi.
Oh, Lombardi. Lombardi will give anybody a tough, tough battle. Right now, he hasn't been too successful, but that's only because of the skills and the abilities of Rotundo and Spivey. But Steve Lombardi's a tough, tough competitor.
That exchange is so great because Vince decides to bring that up as Lombardi is being dominated by Rotundo, and Bruno completely loses the line. Rotundo?
Lombardi's come a long way.
Rotundo?
No, Lombardi.
I love that so much. I might have to make that my text message thing. Every time now I get a text message, I want that to play. As Lombardi gets clotheslined, slammed, but then he avoids an elbow, so he tags out to Paul Christie, the old veteran who's got no knee pads on. That's how you can tell a dude who's been around for a while, if he's still there in the mid to late 80s with no knee pads. He's kind of a short dude. I thought he'd be bigger. Well, I guess maybe I should just call him Dalton. But he gets hit with a double drop kick by Spivey and Rotunda, who then locks in a front face lock, or a Belzer lock, as it was commonly known at the time. But then they end up in the corner. They beat the crap out of Christy a little bit more, but he gets out of there and escapes to tag out. But when Lombardi gets in, he misses the SD Jones Memorial Charge. It feels like there's been a long time between me calling one of those. Anyway, SD Jones is the guy that Lombardi is aspiring to be, at least on the heel side. As Rotunda locks in, well, the airplane spin. I don't know if it's locks in would be the correct terminology for that. And a tag to Spivey rather than finishing him off with the airplane spin. And Spivey hits the slingshot splash, which seemed to be the popular finisher du jour for any manner of teams from 1986. Of course, Bam Bam Bigelow uses it in 87 as a single when he comes in. The Can-Am Connection uses that in between after the U.S. Express leaves and when they have their little heyday early in 87. So, yeah, that's a move that they definitely liked. It's certainly something that felt modern for the 1980s. But as for this iteration of the U.S. Express, the magic was just clearly gone, even though Rotunda and Spivey would later reunite in the NWA shortly after the buyout by Turner. In early 1989, Spivey comes in, joins the Varsity Club, kind of wearing his Georgia Bulldog stuff, because, you know, you got to rep different schools. I like how they had different schools, and it wasn't just, you know, one area of the country. It was kind of from all over the place. It's Syracuse and Michigan and Oklahoma. Not to mention my theory that Kevin Sullivan represents the evilness of the NCAA as part of this group. But anyway, I don't want to get too far off track. The magic was gone for these guys without Wyndham there. I mean, things were going to start to wind down anyway. They regain the tag titles in the middle of 85, and then they drop them right back at the Philly Spectrum to the Dream Team. Don't hold it for very long. But they were very popular. It's just that when you sub one person out, you know, you get another person in there to take the place, and they don't look the same. Things just feel a little bit off. It's never going to quite work as well like when you had the different mom on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, the different Aunt Viv. I think that's the thing to sort of emulate. I don't know which one I liked better, thinking back, because I liked the early episodes of Fresh Prince better. But that might just be a function of where, like, Will and Carlton were in their lives and it being a little bit more relatable. And shows get sillier when they get older. I don't know how I got into Fresh Prince. Oh, yeah. Barry. Yeah, Dan Spivey is the new Aunt Viv, and Barry Windham is the old Aunt Viv. Only if the old Aunt Viv was a sensational worker, 6'6", blonde hair, could get up for drop kicks and all that stuff. But I don't know. Danny Spivey, pretty good in his own right. After all, he would become Waylon Mercy in 1995 WWF, a character that has a little bit more than a few similarities to what Bray Wyatt used to be before he turned into Pee Wee Herman. So it's kind of funny how Mike Rotundo's kid ended up in a gimmick that his tag team partner on this show would eventually have 9 years later.
The topic of this week's update is George the Animal Steel.
Oh, God, that's all I need.
Hey, I'll give you an update for George the Animal Steel in 1986. He kicked out of Macho Man's elbow at WrestleMania 2. I cannot stress enough how unbelievably friggin' weird it is that he kicked out of Macho Man's finisher just middle of the match, like it was a transition move, like it was a Ric Flair backslide or something. Although I guess Kerry beat him with a backslide, but whatever. Anyway, George Steele, he's got the thing going on with Savage all through 86, which, you know, it's a long feud designed to kill time, you know, little comedy matches, and that's fine. You could drive Savage crazy by bringing Elizabeth into it. Steele's TNT spots, they weren't very interesting to me as I'm going through watching that. Although when they did bring out Suzette Lace, or Suzette the Federette, the female therapist for Steele, I did like looking at her. She was pretty good, but they go to a clip of a George Steele match that had recently aired facing John Rizzo, who I could have sworn was one of the Jerky Boys. But no, that was Frank Rizzo. And I wish I could remember all the bits from the Jerky Boys from the mid-90s, from those the two CDs. I don't know if I'm sure that there were more, but I pretty much checked out after the second one. Yeah, this is Frank Rizzo. I just remember, like, what do you bench? And like the crank calls. I was very into that at age 15 or 16. Even if I wouldn't necessarily make crank calls myself, it was, you know, funny to listen to. Same, you know, like listening to the Stern Show back in the day. So they show the end of this match, and what it is, I'm laughing because it is basically a botched hookup to a pin combo, kind of like what a crucifix would be, except, you know, obviously that's not what George Steele is doing, because Rizzo actually rolled over and out of the pinning combination, so they couldn't count it, so Steele had to do it all over again. And blah, 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 he's challenging for the Intercontinental title. Why the hell would you show this? Why would you show a clear botch? Like, there was no other George Steele match from even, like, 85 that you could have showed. But the most interesting part of this update, to me, anyway, is Gene is finishing up. He's wrapping up saying, you know, George Steele going for, you know, after Randy Savage in the Intercontinental title. And this guy walks through in the background with a bag of Utz potato chips and hands one to Gene, who helps himself to some potato chips on the air. I'll tell you, like, I was not joking when I said that they were doing some weird stuff on TV in the spring of 86.
And with an eye on the Intercontinental title and perhaps Miss Elizabeth too, it is... What is this? You've got to be ribbing me. Thank you.
For update, I'm Gene Okerlund.
I'm not going to lie. I've bought Utz potato chips just because they were in the TV show Mad Men with the storyline of that Jimmy Barrett guy who was the comedian who was obnoxious, who did the Utz ads, and then Don Draper banged his wife at some point, and that's how he ended up getting found out by Betty Draper later on. Oh, I'm sorry, spoilers for shows that went off the air 4 years ago, but you should have watched Mad Men already anyway.
We're tanks for nutches!
Thank you, Maggie O'Hooligan from Caddyshack. Yes, that was the character's actual name. As they go to commercial, an ad for Rolaids, which to me seemed like a bigger brand back in the 80s and 90s. Now, maybe that's because other products have come along since then that are superior. I don't know. It just felt like their baseball sponsorships for the Relief Pitcher Awards. It made sense with what the product was and what its stated goal. I don't know. It just doesn't feel like in the year 2019 it has any sort of traction. An ad for Hostess Pudding Pies. I don't remember this at all, but I grew up in a Devil Dogs family. That was the snack of choice. And let me tell you, there are two dudes here, and one of the dudes is way too excited about the cream inside.
Mmm, there's chocolatey icing on top.
Uh-huh.
Great crust. And tons of creamy real vanilla pudding inside. What are you doing?
It does kind of sound like the guy who's eating is just going to start beating off because he's so excited, but instead they stare at each other very awkwardly. I should post a screenshot of that. An ad for the Great America Amusement Park, which is something that still very much exists. And in fact, some of you who attended the abortion that was WrestleMania 31 may have actually gone there because it is right next to Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara, California. The amusement park was started by Marriott Hotels in the 70s, and it was rebooted in 1985. It was actually sold to the city of Santa Clara, as I understood it. And where you've probably seen it the most is in the movie Beverly Hills Cop 3. There are no tunnels underneath like there are in the movie, but yes, Beverly Hills Cop 3. I've never actually seen that one, so maybe I'll go back and check it out. And they advertise for a $3 off coupon that you can get at Jack in the Box. And then the final ad, I'm kind of going out of order with the ads because I got to go, this is the main event ad of this block. It's not the LJN figures, it's the WWF Thumb Wrestlers.
No matter where you are, with Thumb Wrestlers, it's just like being in a wrestling ring. With Hulk Hogan and Rowdy Roddy Piper.
One, two, three, pin!
Wherever you are, it's like real wrestling action. With Junkyard Dog and Bulldog. Thumb Wrestle Anywhere with Hulk in the Iron Sheik.
Okay, kids, back to class.
Wrestle Anywhere with Wrestling Superstars Thumb Wrestlers, new from LJN.
A lot of questions I have about that commercial. Number one, how did Iron Sheik get a job of authority at something like an elementary school? Because don't they test for drugs before you would get a job there? So how would Iron Sheik end up there? Even if he did, I think he probably took a maternity leave when he got pregnant later in the 80s. Because, well, I mean, if you looked at his gut, you would have just assumed. And then Piper and Hogan, like, 1, 2, 3, pin. Like, yeah, as if there's ever been a clean pin in a Hogan-Piper match, kids. God. And I say that I'm a bad booker. You kids suck. But mostly, I wish they'd kind of gone with the thumb wrestler's always a little weird, because when you're playing with the action figures, at least, you know, you're kind of holding them proper, you know, from, like, the head down. But here, you're like sticking your thumb up the ass of your favorite wrestler. It's like all the fun of World Wrestling Federation action plus a simulated colonoscopy. Hey, kids, who wants to drop a digit in Nikolai Volkov?
Play clock at 5. Pass is intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler. Unreal. Malcolm Butler, who almost made the phenomenal play that wound up in Percy's arms. There are flags on the field for a celebration. Amazing.
So that was a totally farcical call.
Well, yeah, most people would call Seattle not running the ball there farcical. However, I will defend it on the grounds that it was second down. They were letting the clock run down. They were probably expecting the Patriots to call a timeout, which if they had, Seattle would have probably run the ball. But by not calling a timeout, Seattle then throws the ball, and it was a play, as it documented in one of the Patriots, like the Sound FX things from the practices, that they had Malcolm Butler ready for that play, because apparently it was something Seattle liked to run, pick plays down at the goal line. So the value of practice there. Are you listening, Allen Iverson? But for my money, that is the greatest Super Bowl of all time. Now, I know, you know, my Philadelphia contingent, once again, will probably weigh in with their favorite, but honestly, you take the Patriots, you know, who've been good for a very long time. You have Seattle, a team that has definitely stood the test of time. It was kind of nearing the end for that Legion of Boom defense, but they had won the Super Bowl the year before. So it was a true clash of the Titans. And that's what you definitely want out of your championship final, is two teams that stand the test of time going one-on-one. A great game, a great finish. Seattle had a 10-point lead in the fourth quarter. The Patriots, 2 touchdown drives in the final 10 minutes. After I brought out the jinx bag, the Super Bowl 40 jinx bag was born on that day. Because, yes, I have a Super Bowl 40 duffel bag because I collect a lot of weird merchandise. That was the game Seattle lost due to some, well, maybe some controversial officiating, but they did lose by 11 points. I put that out with the Patriots down 10, and boom, they ended up winning the game. So for my money, that was the best Super Bowl of all time. But then again, I might be a little biased. So we go to our next match, which is Terry Morgan from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, which tells you this is definitely from the All-Star tapings, because they're still making those in Canada to, you know, kind of meet the content guidelines so that they can maintain that foothold. This aired on All-Star Wrestling May 17th. He's taking on Hercules Hernandez, who has the full last name, and classy Freddie Blassie with him as well. He runs into the ring like a true wild man, almost like John Nord slash Bruiser Brody-ish, because he's got the really long hair and is a bit more of a wild man, like I said. He stomps around. He nearly hits the referee taking a swing. His hair is definitely longer, so things a little different for Hercules coming in, although he did start slow. By the way, Heenan and Gorilla Monsoon are on commentary, so I guess they did do a set of All-Star tapings in the spring, but as I said in the intro, they did a lot of experimentation with the color people that they threw with Gorilla during this time period. When Morgan gets tossed out of the ring the first time, he evades Herc on the outside, gets back into the ring, only to be tossed to the floor again. So I have to admit, one note about Hercules, he looks better with the longer hair. I'm not sure why he didn't go back to that during his babyface run. It kind of gives him a little bit more cachet. And I say that as somebody who would often say, why does everybody have to have long hair in wrestling? Not knowing that, you know, you can cover your mouth with your hair and people won't see you calling spots, stuff like that. So as Morgan is on the outside of the ring, Blassie, who, he's in his late 60s. He's going to be retiring in a few months. He comes over. He drags Morgan back close enough to where Hercules could drag him back into the ring. It's nice to see the old man getting in on the action very, very late in his run. Now, Hercules did not really have much in the way of a program coming in. He had the match against Ricky Steamboat on the LA portion of WrestleMania 2, i.e. near the end, the third of the show that was much better than the other two, because that one definitely got stronger as it went along. So Hercules is just a guy winning on house shows against people who are clearly below him, like your Lanny Poffos and those type of guys. And it's odd, given that he isn't terrible. You'd think that maybe he'd have something waiting for him. But he finally gets that pairing with Billy Jack Haynes in the fall. And then the bigger break is shortly after that, when he faces Hulk Hogan on Saturday Night's Main Event in November of 86, gets him in the backbreaker, and then does the stupid heel thing of releasing him thinking that he has won. At that point, he had gone from Blassie to Slick, where he had his contract sold to, or Slick purchased half of Blassie's guys and then purchased the other half later. It sounds like a hitman sort of job, and I don't mean Bret Hart. All right, I'm going to pay you half now and half when the job is done. But Slick, I guess, needing capital for whatever reason, sells him to Bobby Heenan, and Hercules has no problem with this, even though he would have issues with his contract being sold later on to Ted DiBiase. Apparently, though, Hercules, and this is from listening to Paul Roma on what used to be the Steve Austin Show before he just started releasing reruns for basically the last 8 months. At least there hasn't been any Ted Fowler stuff, so maybe I shouldn't complain. Hercules was apparently a very wry, funny dude, you know, sarcastic, and I don't know, sounds like somebody that I would get along with, at least based on the accounts of Paul Roma, his teammate in Power and Glory. The elbow drop, and he does it here, where he jumps into the air, is very distinctive. If you just showed like a silhouette of a guy doing the Hercules elbow, I mean, I'm calling it the Hercules elbow drop because he's one of the guys that would do that. I mean, Dino Bravo would jump for an elbow drop, but he sucks, and maybe I'd be able to pick him out, but with Hercules, it was very, very distinctive, and I like that, where guys really stand out and make something their own. Clothesline, a slam, he drops Morgan on the top rope, and then hits a forearm off the second rope where he pretty much went almost all the way across the ring. I'm sure Shane McMahon was looking at that and saying, you know what? I'm going to do that move when I waste everybody's time for about 12 WrestleManias wrestling in matches where, well, we're going to have to stick people in a freaking battle royal who actually deserve to have these matches. But, hey, I'm going to keep doing it until I'm 56 years old for whatever reason. Sorry, just had to get in my 2 cents on that. I mean, after all, I didn't even see Shane versus The Miz. I was too busy trying to get coffee at WrestleMania, which, by the way, my WrestleMania recap thing, go back in the archives and check that out. On commentary, it's interesting to hear Heenan talk about Hercules, given that he would be a charge of his just a few months down the road, and he definitely likes what he sees.
Yeah, I don't know what Freddie's done, but I've never seen Hernandez this vicious. I love it. That's a winner in there. He certainly is a very vicious individual. There's no question about that. But I would like to see it here in the World Wrestling Federation with a little stiffer competition, Bobby.
I imagine he would too.
Hey, you go with Bobby, it's going to give your career a boost. I mean, hell, you could say, oh, what about the Red Rooster? It's like, well, he got shots on NBC on multiple occasions. He got a WrestleMania match out of the deal. So I don't know what you're talking about. The Red Rooster was clearly a great success. Anyway, delayed vertical by Hercules. Kind of thought he was going to go for a jackhammer there. I can't believe... All right, I got to mention this. And the delayed vertical into a jackhammer. I have to mention, I could not believe that Goldberg... Goldberg is going to make his return at a show in Saudi Arabia. I cannot stress enough just how insane that is to me. But whatever. I mean, I'm sure the money's good. I'm not going to begrudge him that. But this Jewish man making his return to the ring after a couple of years in Saudi Arabia. But I do like the joke of with Goldberg versus The Undertaker. Clearly, the Saudi prince is now up to 2003 in his WWE network. All right, I gotta get out of this. Backbreaker finishes for Hercules. There's not much reaction to him, and it's because I think that he doesn't really have much of an issue with anybody. In fact, a few people are applauding Hercules. He's got Blassie there. Why are you applauding this man? Then I remembered, oh yeah, that's right. These are the Canada tapings. The Canadians are so damn polite. And maybe that's why they had to stop taping there. They were turning into that bizarro world where they were just giving polite applause to the heels if they, you know, looked cool for a little bit.
Ladies and gentlemen, the World Wrestling Federation returns to Sacramento Arco Arena Wednesday night, June 25th.
At that point in 1986, they had two house show circuits running, and they had taped in Poughkeepsie the day before on June 24th. So one of those shows was in Binghamton, New York, and then you have this one in Sacramento. So some guys were on the taping in Poughkeepsie and had to fly out to Sacramento for the Arco Arena show the next day. This is actually before the Arco Arena was rebuilt for the Sacramento Kings to come in. They actually moved to Sacramento in 1985 from Kansas City. Here is the show. There is no attendance listed for June 25th, 1986. Siviafi versus George Wells, Killer Bees versus Iron Mike Sharp and Rene Goulet, Cowboy Bob Orton versus Leapin' Lanny Poffo, King Kong Bundy versus Cousin Luke. I feel like that would be a fun one to watch because it would probably be a squash in 2 minutes. Paul Orndorff versus Magnificent Morocco in a WrestleMania 2 rematch, and our main event, the Dream Team of Greg the Hammer Valentine and Brutus Beefcake, challenging once again the tag team champions, the British Bulldogs, Davey Boy Smith, and the Dynamite Kid in a steel cage match. And Ken Resnick is there with the British Bulldogs. And God help us, there is no Captain Lou Albano in sight, so he will not be along to at least add some gravitas to this promo. There's no Matilda. We're not going to see her for a couple of months. Hell, we don't even get freaking Ozzy Osbourne, who at WrestleMania 2 made the solemn promise in a wrestling ring that the British Bulldogs forever, and that he wanted to manage them going forward. But nope, instead, we are stuck with, as I said, God help us, Dynamite Kid's going to talk.
You know something, Ken? Valentine, Beefcake, and Valiant. They said, since the Bulldogs took these belts away from them in WrestleMania 2, we've been running away. We've been running from them. We don't want no matches with them. But the thing is, right now, in Sacramento, they've got a 12-foot steel cage, all four men in the ring, and there's no way out. You can go over the top, or you can get pinned 1, 2, 3.
I'm a fan of the British accent. I mean, this is the show that Richard Land requested, but I don't think it's because of this promo from Dynamite, which made absolutely no sense whatsoever, because he says, it's in a steel cage, and there's no way out, unless you climb over the top. So what you're saying is, there is a way out. That's Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Famer Dynamite Kid. Apparently, intelligence, not a prerequisite for voting. And also, if he happened to murder his wife and kid, it would have been fine as well. But let's see what Davey Boy Smith, who may have done a few things to his wife, if you believe Diana Smith's account, which you probably shouldn't because she's just as batshit as the rest of them. Let's see if old Danny Boy, as Angelo Mosca once called him, Danny Boy Smith, in a 1984 show. Let's see if he does any better.
Yeah, but that night, Johnny Valiant won't be doing anything because Johnny Valiant hasn't got the stamina to climb over that 12-foot cage. There's going to be me, the Dynamite Kid, Beefcake, and Valentine in that ring. There's only two guys going to walk out, and that's the British Bulldogs still holding these belts right there in the Arco Arena in Sacramento, California.
I was going to deem it passable until he called the arena the Aqua Arena, which I know it might be an accent thing, and I probably shouldn't cast judgment, but it's only called the Aqua Arena when Barbie Girl is playing over the PA system. So why don't we just go into commercial with an ad that is more bizarre than the British Bulldog at a Royal Rumble. Something for the, it's called the Cal Expo. It's one of those things where you go to like the exposition center in the city and they have all this electronics equipment, you know, marked down or whatever. And here they like to demonstrate it by having a actual fire on a stereo system. Like the stereo system itself is on fire. Some to talk about, you know, cutting prices, they show a guy chainsawing through a VCR. They're really making their point with that. with the technology that was available at the time. It's like, well, good thing that the Bret Hart-Tom McGee match wasn't in that VCR when you chainsawed it, huh? Yeah, I know. It was a little bit later in 86, but you know, please take my point in the spirit in which it's intended. This is also an ad for Rent-A-Center. Speaking of outdated technology, $19.95 a week for a TV VCR combo seems pretty steep for 1986, given that I think the price of TVs had fallen enough where you could probably get like a 15-inch TV and just be fine. And then VCRs were still pretty pricey. But yeah, renting those type of things was never going to work out for you in the long run. And a Taco Bell commercial where their slogan at that point is "Leave your burger game." So they're trying to get people to stop going to McDonald's. Not a problem for me. Burger King, Wendy's, to go and try Mexican food. Now, it's interesting that they're advertising on the wrestling show where every time Tito Santana shows up, they're just going to make a bunch of Mexican food jokes. And then an ad for LA Beer, which seems to have some sort of Australian connection to it, even though it is manufactured by Anheuser-Busch, and they make sure to say that it is brewed in America, saying it is a lighter beer. I don't know what they're going for, but Crocodile Dundee doesn't come out for a couple months. So if you're going to play the Australia card, it's a good time to do it now, albeit a little early. If you wait a couple of months, you would have timed it perfectly.
Breezy back in it goes. O'Connor catches. He'll leave.
Oh, it's in! Oh, my God! Matt O'Connor for the second straight game gives the opponent a gimme, and we're tied at three.
Wow.
No, I don't want to talk about the Boston University goalie basically dropping the puck into his own net in the third period of the national championship game against Providence, which took place at TD Garden in Boston, of all places. And it always makes me mad walking around TD Garden before a game or something like that when I see a picture that references this event in which the Boston team lost to the team from Rhode Island. Quite frankly, it should be expunged from the record a la Chris Benoit from WWE's records. It should be acknowledged that that event never took place at that arena. It would be very nice if they would do that, considering that they are basically insulting more of their own fans because there are more BU fans than Providence fans. I'm sorry. That's just a fact. So up next, we have Candace Perdue taking on Judy Martin, a woman once referred to by Brickhouse Brown as a world champion in the bedroom. Now, I don't know how far that goes, or I can't check the veracity of it because, well, I never slept with Judy Martin, and there are no tapes, so it's not like we can break down the game footage with somebody, you know, like a Sonny. So Candice Perdue was also on TNT early in the year, back in January. It's a very uncomfortable segment when you tune in for it, where she does a weightlifting thing. She also does, it's not exactly the most attractive look for her, wearing a sort of tracksuit sort of thing. She looks like the child female version of The Undertaker, but like The Undertaker's high school yearbook photo that has been posted on Twitter. I believe Alan_Cheapshot on Twitter has posted that at some point. And the way she looked, I don't think it's necessarily the red hair. It's also the eyes and all that. Now, she lost an arm wrestling match to a guy on there for which Vince had to think fast and quickly disqualify the guy for cheating and just kind of make it up. So not a good segment all around. It lasted about 4 or 5 minutes, which was a little bit less than the Paul Christie one we're going to see a little bit later. Judy Martin. Now, this might be a reason why Richard Landa picked this show, because I know he has spoken highly of Judy Martin being particularly underrated during the era of fabulous Moolah trainees, and she is one of them, just kind of doing the same hair-pulling match, which Judy Martin, you know, would fall into, but I think that she was trapped because she had bad opponents. But there is one hidden... I don't know how hidden this is at this point, because I don't know if this show is on the network. It's from the Boston Garden. I know they put a lot of the Boston Garden shows up. June 22nd, 1985, against Desiree Peterson. It aired on both Primetime Wrestling and All-American Wrestling, so I guess neither one of them are on the network. But you can seek the match out on YouTube. It's pretty wild, and unlike a lot of the other women's matches you would see around that time, Gorilla Monsoon and Mean Gene are on commentary. It starts out hot with Gorilla questioning the weight of Judy Martin as being billed at 160. He said, oh, that's clearly a low number. And Judy Martin proceeds in that match as if she heard the entire thing and heard all the snarky comments and just beats the piss out of Desiree. Of course, Desiree ends up prevailing in the end, as would always seem to happen with Judy Martin, where she never could seem to get that big victory. Judy would go on and become a member of law enforcement. I saw something with her. She was a prison guard at one point, presumably in a women's prison, although I wouldn't put it past her if she was a prison guard in a male prison. Kind of funny. She did the reverse Big Boss Man. But it also said somewhere she was a transcriber of medical records. I'm not sure what that job entails and how that's different from medical coding. Should probably call Keithy and ask him, since he's the expert in that field. Heenan is on commentary here, along with Gorilla Monsoon, with this being from the All-Star tapings. And the Brain lets us know up front, he's not particularly familiar with the women's division for whatever it was worth in 1986.
The girl with the red hair, what is her name?
Candice Perdue.
Candice Perdue.
No relation to Frank.
It seems like something you'd see on the menu next to chocolate mousse.
I was kind of expecting a, will you stop? But this is very early in their run, and they hadn't quite developed the famous chemistry just yet, but it would be a long in short order. I'm just happy that 10-year-old Stephanie McMahon isn't there to slap the shit out of Heenan for insulting women's wrestling, which was invented by Stephanie earlier. It just didn't become apparent until the 2010s. A slam exchange between the two, and Judy, when Candice goes for the pin, kicks out prior to one. You don't see that very often, but Candice starts working on the arm to kind of get this match going a little bit slowly, and Heenan ponders how he would feel if his wife decided to go into wrestling.
You know, if I had a wife that was a wrestler or wanted to be a wrestler, I wouldn't let her go and wrestle.
Why is that?
Well, not until all the housework was done, the dishes were done, the kids were tucked in, put to bed.
But that would be all right, right?
Well, if she made money.
Oh.
Yeah, I know, that's definitely sexist. But as Nigel Tufnel said in Spinal Tap, well, what's wrong with being sexy? And again, Gorilla, not as indignant. I think he's kind of waiting for what Heenan has to say and is just kind of do the, huh, you know, a little bit more low-key in his indignation towards the Brain. Judy runs into knees in the corner, but then Candice misses a drop kick, which is followed by a miss elbow by Judy Martin. A common trope of the women's matches at the time. Talk about the snapmare hair pulls, but they would also do the each girl misses a move and then the other girl misses a move, which I feel like I've seen that in a lot of 80s women's matches. Granted, you know, I haven't watched them all or anything, but there's no clean break in the corner from Judy Martin, who then tosses Pardue by the hair, which I mentioned that not because it was coming up next, but because it was something that you would see in every match. It was a staple of the Moolah stuff, for better or worse, mostly worse. This is where I start to really notice, because they're wearing bathing suits as their gear. I mean, that was the thing in the 80s, and Judy definitely has junk in the trunk. Pretty sure that's the expression the kids use these days. I don't know. I'm an old man. I hate everything but Matlock. Ooh, it's on now. Backdrop by Candice off a reverse Irish whip, and a back elbow gets a two count. But this just has the feel of her firing up briefly before Judy Martin catches Perdue, who puts her head down. A cardinal mistake by a ring veteran. And she doesn't go for a pile driver or a backbreaker or any of that nonsense. Even if Gorilla calls it a backbreaker, Judy Martin, in the year 1986, finishes her off with the powerbomb. Now, I know the true historians are going to roll in and be like, well, Luthez was doing a powerbomb in 1952. Like, yes, Luthez is great. That's great, grand, wonderful. But I'm talking on World Wrestling Federation television in the 1980s. It's not like you'd see a lot of powerbombs. Even when you get to 1991, Sid's doing it on the other side of the world. But when Tenryu does it to, I think, Smash at WrestleMania 7, it's still kind of a big deal 5 years after this. So Judy Martin laying out Candice Perdue with a powerbomb and picking up the victory. I think Judy was pretty underrated, although a lot of people may remember her now from the Glamour Girls tag team alongside Leilani Kai and their feud with the Jumping Bomb Angels in late 87 and early 88 because of the quality of the matches that they would have. So you may not remember her as much for her singles stuff because she, quite frankly, she was losing a lot of the time and never really got that title shot. And when she did, she was stuck with a crappy opponent like a Rockin' Robin at Royal Rumble 1989, a match I would personally like to forget because it led to Rockin' Robin doing America the Beautiful at WrestleMania 5, and crown thy good with brotherhood. They should have had Judy Martin sing it instead, because she is truly one of the greats. And I know one place where Judy Martin may potentially get her due, and that is ProWrestlingOnly.com. And while you're there, you can explore other podcasts, such as WorldCast. The last 2 weeks has been taking a look at that Dark Side of the Ring series, the ones that have more to do with World Class Championship Wrestling, since that is the promotion that they are covering. They looked at the Von Erichs documentary from last week's show, and then this week they're looking at the Gino Hernandez. I'm way behind. I need to actually go in and watch those, but it's been some very good podcasts in covering those. While at Pro Wrestling Only, you can check out match reviews, features, and retrospectives such as the Walking in Memphis series, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances, and non-wrestling TV shows. That's kind of my forte, even though I haven't written anything about that, and much more. Join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums. It's been online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members. Maybe it's up to 2,050 by now. Anyway, archive of a hell of a lot of threads. The message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific Judy Martin match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive into Judy Martin's, well, not her sex life, but her career in the microscope form, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present that go far past Judy Martin. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
But Bobby the Brain, a match many of you fans saw recently on national television. Tag team action between Big John Studd, King Kong Bundy, and the British Bulldogs. I think the only time in your career you were very ruffled, it looked like you were totally out of control, perhaps some disharmony emerging in the Bobby Heenan family.
Definitely not. Definitely not. The incident you're referring to is when Bundy and Studd reached that point of wanting victory so bad. They're competitive athletes.
One of the reasons why I like going back and watching the weekly television programs rather than, say, just WrestleManias or just pay-per-views, super shows, Saturday Night's Main Event, is you can miss these little things that were teased or angles that never quite came to fruition but happened to be of interest. And this is one of them. And they actually did this a couple times with King Kong Bundy during the year. They tease a breakup with Big John Studd and King Kong Bundy, who formed a tag team shortly after WrestleMania 2 because you wanted to give Bundy something to do on the way down but keep him strong. And they had a match against the British Bulldogs on Championship Wrestling on May 17th where there was some shoving between the two at the end. It ended up in a disqualification when Studd assaulted the referee, something to that effect. Which makes me wonder, just kind of in my head, where this might have gone. You would think, okay, now one of them is going to turn, and why would you do this? Well, Andre the Giant's not around. The machines thing hasn't started, and even when he's in the machines, he's not wrestling a whole hell of a lot. So what do you do with these two guys without their main natural rival around? Well, maybe you split them up and have them feud with each other. Who would you have as the babyface? King Kong Bundy makes more sense because he seems to be more of a natural fit as a babyface. Sure, he could do both, but we learned years later Big John Studd as a babyface really was not something that was going to captivate audiences around the world. Bundy has a certain lovable quality to him, where you can just see something deep inside, like, yes, this is a man who has 10 cats, or this is a guy who's very jovial and appears on TV shows and in advertisements for computers as he would later on. He just strikes me as more likable. So that's where you think it might go with it. So Heenan is here with Ken Resnick. They're not promoting anything in particular, just talking about the tension in the team that arose from that match. And Resnick raises the question to Heenan, I'm kind of with Heenan on this, about why Studd and Bundy aren't out for the interview.
Something happened during the match. They had a little bit of a collision, but being competitive like they are and wanting to win so badly, yes, they're high-strung athletes. You've seen football games. Football players slap each other in the head. They hit each other in shoulder pads. Hockey players shove each other. Baseball players give it that high five. That's all they're doing. If you're trying to start some trouble with me and John Studd and King Kong Bunny, well, you're badly mistaken, because there's nothing but harmony in my family.
Well, Bobby Heenan, if what you say is true and what we all saw on national television is an untruth, why then are King Kong Bundy and Big John Studd not out here with you?
They don't have to be here with me every time, and I don't have to answer to you. And the last thing I have to do is explain myself to you poor subhumanoids out there.
Yeah, I'm with the brain. That's why he's there. Those two guys don't need to come out for every interview segment, especially with a team. You got three of them there. Now, I know I said differently when the British Bulldogs were out there, but I don't know what the hell was wrong. Lou was probably drunk. Heenan is sober here. Once again, he's wearing a suit, which I wish we had gotten more suit, Bobby Heenan, but apparently he liked those jumpsuits that you would wear later on because it made it much easier for him to pack on the road, so I'm certainly not going to begrudge him that. So we go to a commercial break, and we get a lot of the same ones as before for Great America, and the host is putting the somewhat homoerotic ad. And you're not going to believe this, but there's an ad for acne medication on a wrestling program in the 1980s, Oxy-10. The one that gets my attention during this ad break is an ad for Stetson Cologne.
Need help?
Yeah, and I've got 10 minutes to get to the radio station.
Ah, here's the problem.
Easy for you.
Ever listen to KVLY?
Should I?
Stetson Cologne. Comfortable, easy to wear. Easy
for you. And for that great smelling guy who started my car, I get off at 6.
Easy to wear, hard to resist. Stetson Mints.
Now, that commercial is fascinating to me because this woman, her car breaks down on the way to work at the radio station, and she accepts help from this guy because he smells good. So I guess the lesson is wear Stetson cologne and women will hit on you when you try to help them. It doesn't feel plausible, especially since we're coming off the 70s when like 89% of people would be murdered in that situation, or at least it feels that way. Probably watched too many serial killer documentaries. The fact that she shows female empowerment by just openly hitting on him from the word go, and then gives him the shout out on KPLY radio, which, by the way, was not a radio station that exists then, but today the letters KPLY is a sports radio station in Reno, Nevada. Which, you know, given the background and that, I don't think that they were in Reno, so let's just forget about all of that. So, do you think that these two screwed later? Do you think they went out on a date? I tend to doubt it, because she works at a radio station, and the guy clearly doesn't know too much about it. So, I don't think that they have the same interest in music. I'm pretty sure that these two couldn't get together.
Cecil, he delivers again. JJ hits a ground ball up the middle and into center field. Davis are on third. He's going to be waved in, and he's going to score without a play.
So Hardy, a two RBI day. A couple of big hits in this ball game.
Baltimore goes up 10-9. They go on to win it by a final of 13-9.
2015 was the first year I went up to Toronto for an Orioles-Blue Jays series. I went up in 15, 16, and 17. But that game on June 21st was the first time I had this single seat behind home plate where I learned, apparently I was on camera for the Baltimore telecast. So when the road team telecast, it shoots a little bit higher and you could see the first row behind the premium seats. And that was a memorable game for the Orioles scoring 7 runs in the second inning and the Blue Jays answering with 6 runs in the bottom of the second. So the game goes, Baltimore scores 7, Toronto scores 9, and then Baltimore scores the last 6 runs. So some crazy win probability changes in that game. And it was a great memory because my friend Craig texts me in the middle of it. It's like, is that you behind home plate? He's like, you got to hunch down. And then he's like, what do you got in your cup? I'm drinking Coke. What are you doing now? Like, I'm not doing anything. I'm trying to watch the freaking game. But it was a lot of fun because there's some guy in the premium seating area who's like the mayor of the section. He gave me like a free program, free peanuts that I then smuggled back into America. I'm pretty sure the statute of limitations has passed on that. So a lot of fun. I really got to get back to Toronto for another baseball game or maybe a playoff hockey game at some point. Though those always seem to go, well, fairly well, maybe 60% of the time. But I mentioned a few episodes ago that when I smoked, a lot of interesting things would happen to me, you know, where I'm just walking around. And some of the stuff on that trip, like being able to give wedding advice to a groomsman party in a Tim Hortons, which is literally the most Canadian thing I have ever done in my entire life. And hanging out with these dudes from Peterborough outside some bar in the smoker leper colony. I mean, those are the kind of things that can't happen. But again, don't smoke, kids. It's too damn expensive and it's not good for your health. And anyway, if I start talking about Canada more, I'm going to have to do an episode of Maple Leaf with Angelo Mosca. So up next, we have Ron Shaw taking on Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. So now he's in full dragon regalia. When we saw him on the March of 85 episode of Championship Wrestling, he was just Ricky Steamboat. And he comes to the ring to Sirius as God intended. But you notice that his hair looks a little bit weird in the front, where it's like very, very short. So you could see much more of his forehead than you could before. And this is an actual angle that is alluded to on TV, where he said he wanted his hair short so that when he looked in the mirror, he could see the knot in his head from the DDT he took from Jake the Snake Roberts on the Saturday Night's Main Event. So a nice storytelling touch from Ricky Steamboat, which, no surprise. I mean, this is one of the most secure dudes in the history of wrestling to take that DDT on the floor, make it look as fantastic as it did, and then have the snake thrown on him like that. Not a lot of baby faces had that done to them by Jake. I mean, yeah, George Wells, but I'm talking consequential baby faces. Even when Jake goes baby faces, not a lot of heels outside of Hercules, I remember, at SummerSlam 88. So it's kind of a sign of how secure he was in his role in the WWF. They referred to the dragon as more aggressive, which is always code for the baby face is really pissed off. And Ricky Steamboat does that as well as anybody. He starts out with a power slam off an Irish whip, and that gets 8 Ted DiBiase's out of 10. I would thought about giving him the full 10, but you got to leave a little bit of room, or otherwise I'm just going to be some asshole giving out 6 stars when you've had a 5-star ranking system for years and years. Shaw gets tossed to the outside. And I don't know, I sometimes do this as I'm watching matches for this show, and I'm thinking about how Ricky Steamboat could never be a heel. You just can only refer to him as a very angry man at this point, as Bruno does. And I just think of matches with Ricky Steamboat that we never got to see. Because Steamboat is a pretty easy guy to book angles for. You just do ASR, attack, sympathy, revenge. That's all there is to it. It's a very simple formula in professional wrestling. It gets overthought. But you think of the first 3 big angles he's in the WWF after jumping in 1985. Magnificent Morocco and Mr. Fuji. They hang him over the top rope. And he looks like he's dying there. You have sympathy for him, naturally. He comes back, gets revenge. Jake, with the DDT, throws the snake on him. All right, you get sympathy because he's got the knot in his head now. He's unconscious, all that on national television. And then finally, later in 1986, as I covered several episodes ago, the superstars from November of 1986, the Macho Man Randy Savage attacking, literally going for the throat of Ricky Steamboat. The attack with the bell, sympathy as he's hospitalized, and they have the weird talk segments where they bring in his wife. Maybe that wasn't so great, but you wanted him to come back for revenge. Like I said, it's a very simple formula. It's not difficult, even though, as I always say, I am a terrible booker. So if I just stick to that, I could perhaps improve. I would have liked to see Ricky Steamboat against a big guy, like a King Kong Bundy. Well, I did look it up. He did face Big John Studd in 1977 in the Crockett territory, and there's only a clip of that match where he's getting the crap beat out of him by Studd, who's a little bit more spry at that point. Or hell, here's another opponent for Ricky Steamboat from this era of WWF. Adrian Adonis. Can you imagine those two guys selling for each other? Holy crap. But they actually did face each other in tag matches as I looked it up. So yeah, I just like to sit around and think of Ricky Steamboat matches that I wish we'd had, because he crosses a lot off the list. You got Steve Austin, you got Rick Rude, you got obviously Ric Flair through three different decades. So there's a lot there, but you can also think about the stuff that didn't happen. So Ricky, he's wearing the headband, but he keeps it on for this match. And Bruno makes a very interesting comment referring to the mild concussion that Steamboat had. Not a word you would hear on WWF television often in the 80s, back when, you know, concussion awareness was not what it is now. So the fired up Dragon, as he is in this match, always the best. I'm sorry, I made an accidental pun there, but let's, you know, the less said about the 91 Steamboat, the better. The DDT that Steamboat took on the floor on Saturday Night's Main Event was so good, it probably, you know, led to some copycat incidents around the country. And with that in mind, Vince McMahon lays down a PSA for the viewing audience.
By the way, just a word of caution to you youngsters out there who might be watching some of these maneuvers by the Dragon, or for that matter, any of the World Wrestling Federation wrestlers, you are not to try those maneuvers at home. It is most dangerous. Please leave the wrestling up to the professionals. I'm sure you'd agree with that, Bruno.
Absolutely. Watch wrestling. Enjoy it. Remember, these guys are top professionals. They've been trained to do this all their lives. And some children may try this not realizing how devastating some of these maneuvers can be, and they can do some real damage to one another. So please don't do it.
Something must have happened. There must have been a story somewhere where some kid did something to another kid and he got hurt really, really bad, like a pile driver or a DDT. I mean, after all, even the best workers, like myself, in a dorm room at Boston University can take a DDT wrong and, you know, get a knot on your head. So basically, I'm kind of like Ricky Steamboat in that way. And that's pretty much the only comparison you could make between me and him, other than, you know, I tried to be a kindly baby face on this podcast, i.e. not an asshole a la a Peter Rosenberg character. Shoulder block off an Irish whip by Steamboat, setting up the flying body press off the top, which looks beautiful as usual, where Steamboat hooks the leg on the way down. I always love when he gets that leg hooked right in fluid motion in the move. And Ron Shaw, he's a professional, so he knows how to take the move. So Ricky Steamboat, that feud is heating up with Jake, but you always want to see a little bit more of him, and I'm dreaming of matches with him and Adrian Adonis for whatever reason. So we go to Vince McMahon and Lord Al in the studio, who coincidentally enough are going to toss it to the Body Shop with a guest, Adrian Adonis. So things are a little mixed up, where Adonis is hosting the Flower Shop on Championship Wrestling, but we're going to show the Body Shop, hosted now by Magnificent Morocco and Mr. Fuji, which is really weird that Mr. Fuji is just kind of hanging around in the back, a la the Bob Orton role from the old Piper's Pits. The Body Shop, Jesse Ventura was doing up until a few shows after WrestleMania 2 that had been taped prior to WrestleMania 2, when Jesse departed for a few months to go make Predator.
It's quite a switch having Morocco and Fuji in the Body Shop as hosts, too.
Adrian is quite a switch in his own right, isn't he?
He has switched, let's face it.
He has?
He definitely has.
Starting at the beginning of 1986, it's very interesting to watch how it evolves, the gimmick of adorable Adrian Adonis, because here they're not saying the word gay. I mean, that much is made clear in, you know, how he's acting and how over the top everything is. But what's sometimes forgotten is back in January of 86, He outright says, "I'm gay," like he's Ellen DeGeneres on TV 11 years later.
And I'm going to say something right now and admit it right now. Everybody wants to hear it, and I'm going to say it. Yes, I'm gay.
Smash cut to 10 years later in 1996, and you have Goldust, and there's an obvious comparison between adorable Adrian and Goldust, and you couldn't stop the crowd from yelling homophobic slurs at Goldust in 96. So in 86, it's nobody's yelling anything in the studio, thank God, but they definitely toned it down with the, in terms of not him not saying that he's gay every time he's out on, he's kind of letting his actions do the talking because he doesn't really need to say it. Now, this segment is from the May 31st episode of All Star, so the same weekend, as Morocco says that he and Fuji are the WWF's primetime players. What, are they going to be like a lower card tag team now, and one of them is going to do a lot of charity work? I don't know.
Lovely to see you. I want to say something right now. Don Morocco, you are a natural athlete just like myself.
I have always admired your talents, your wrestling skills, your wrestling abilities, but most of all, your viciousness and your brutality.
Oh, thank you very much.
Hold up, enough about Adonis. What the hell is going on with Morocco's voice? He sounds like Nina Blackwood and smoking three packs a day or whatever. What the hell happened to him? Or better yet, I'll even make it a little bit more esoteric. It's like Babe Ruth's retirement speech from like 1947 when he's dying of cancer.
The only real game, I think, in the world, baseball.
Baseball, baseball, baseball.
Well, now that I think about it, Morocco, probably not so much a tobacco user, although it would explain some of his lazier performances in the ring. Because I remember back in 83, he does this promo on Pat Patterson that I covered. It's the December 31st, 83 episode, I think, of Championship Wrestling. And he has definitely smoked a lot of grass before that. So maybe it has something to do with that. I don't know. So we continue along here, and we get Jimmy Hoffa being brought up, and they share a common issue, which is finding opponents.
You know something? After I get rid of every opponent in the past, they have disappeared faster than Jimmy Hoffa. Nobody, this man right here, Jimmy Hart, carries around contracts with him, a stack of 5,200. Which,
will anybody wrestle you?
They have been thrown in front of Hogan's face. He has refused to sign. He all of a sudden had arthritis. They have been thrown in front of the Junkyard Dog face and a cast of 1,000. Donnie, you are fantastic. Both of us together would be unbeatable. Have you ever thought of that? Two sticks, two pieces of metal are harder to break than one.
The British Chihuahuas, are you talking? Do you like Chihuahua meat? You know, you have the same problem I do. Finding suitable opponents.
It is kind of natural that these guys would get along and be allies. They both host talk shows on the various syndicated programs. They both took over for higher profile names who departed at WrestleMania 2. I don't know. And then I think back to the first episode of Greetings from Allentown. Who was the guest on the flower shop when they had the battle with Piper's Pit? It was Magnificent Morocco. So, yes, I guess it did carry over for a while. And this is a pretty good promo, except when we get to the end, it's a little eerie given what the final fate of Adrian Adonis was.
No doubt. No doubt in my mind and the people out there. We are Vegematics. We slice and dice. And for no extra charge, we will turn them into Julian French fries. I'd like to say goodbye.
No, it's their pleasure to be here.
Drive defensively and may the Lord be your companion.
Given that Adonis would die in a car crash on July 4th, 1988, another victim of wrestling's alleged July 4th curse, or a number of guys have died over the years. I don't know, it's very spooky to hear him say, drive safely. I don't know, merely a coincidence, just kind of an observation. So they go to the ad break, and the first ad is for Schick razors. These do not appear to be disposables, but they don't look like they're of great quality, although it says that it lubricates as you shave. And it's a guy at a post-work gathering who runs into the bathroom to shave his 5 o'clock shadow. I sometimes see people in the bathroom at work shaving, and I think that that is a little bit weird. But then again, you know, my facial hair, I guess, doesn't grow as quickly. All I know is that during the hockey playoffs, I don't grow my beard like the players do. I only shave on the days that they're not playing. So as I record this, this is not a game day, so I actually shaved this morning. Anyway, it's completely irrelevant. Next two commercials are for Honda scooters with Jim McMahon, the quarterback of the Super Bowl champion Chicago Bears. Now, talk about an athlete who made sure to capitalize on his 15 minutes of fame with him being outrageous and the whole, you know, getting in trouble with Pete Rozelle. I know, a Super Bowl quarterback having a feud with the commissioner. I can't believe it. And yeah, you're not going to get any Deflategate stuff from me for 2015. But Jim McMahon definitely needed to do that right then and there because he was extremely injury prone for the rest of his career. I mean, I didn't particularly care for that time he got cheap shotted by, I think it was that guy on either Washington or Green Bay who just like threw him down like a rag doll after the whistle. And then finally, another ad for the Cal Expo, which the chainsaw going through the VCR is definitely my favorite part of that. First off, again, apologies to Texas Rangers fans. I'm not trying to antagonize you. It's just that your team happened to be on the losing end of a lot of weird stuff in the 2010s. The Game 5 of the ALDS against Toronto. Yeah, everybody remembers Jose Bautista and the bat flip, but please don't forget that Bautista is an obnoxious asshole. What I want to draw attention to is Texas took the lead in the top of the seventh when the runner from third came home because the catcher, in throwing the ball back to the pitcher, hit the bat of the batter who was just standing there, and the ball ricocheted away. The guy scores. The crowd was pissed about it, threw beer cans on the field, but that was crazy enough. Here's how the bottom of the seventh inning starts before the home run by Bautista to give them the three-run lead. Error, shortstop. Error, third baseman. Error, shortstop, and then a ground out, because now you get the base loaded, and they get the force out at home, and then a pop fly for the second out. They tie the game there, and then Bautista hits the home run. One of the craziest innings in baseball history, just absolutely batshit. Of course, next year there will be, in 2016, another crazy game in Toronto, of which I was very upset about certain decisions that were made in that one. So anyway, another person who made some pretty bad decisions is Paul Christie as they go to Tuesday Night Titans, which was not airing on Tuesday night. It was either airing on Wednesday or Friday. I love how they just stuck with that name. Of course, Bill Simmons named his show Any Given Wednesday and it got canceled, but that probably had more to do with it being Bill Simmons than, you know, the whole Wednesday thing, and it was the only day you could put it on. Now, for those of you, I mentioned Christie because he was in the match earlier. For those of you not familiar with him, he's kind of your typical veteran journeyman. He had bounced around various territories, made a name for himself in ICW, the PAFO territory, in fact, defeated Randy Savage for the title of that promotion. He is actually still alive. He was 47 years old in 1986, so it's not like he was some young hotshot coming in. He had been around the block about six or seven times, and it's just a very odd presence that he cuts. But TNT would often have these low-card guys on, which I loved, because there's an episode from May of 1985 that I've just been pushing back, which is basically just enhancement guys for the entire hour, and I really should get to that one. Christie did write a book in 2005 called The Many Faces of Paul Christie, which had a lot of the wrestler brags about getting a lot of poontang on the road, that sort of stuff, which is strange because he was always associated with his wife, Bunny Love, who they called themselves the Bonnie and Clyde of wrestling, or at least that's how they build themselves in their team. But as for the book, there's no Kindle copy that I was able to purchase, and there was no way for me to pull any clips of it. The reviews of it are pretty interesting in that I think there's 1 5-star review, 1 4-star review, 1 3-star review, and 1 1-star review. So I'll read the 3-star review from Witch Lit Chick. Easy for me to say. And it's entitled, Grammar is Not His Friend. This book would have been a lot more interesting if it had been properly edited. There are numerous grammatical and spelling errors that constantly took away from the flow of the story. I suppose it shows the education level of the author and made me feel sorry for his partner as her side of the story was just as bad. And that's a 3-star review. Maybe I should have read the 1-star review. But like a lot of old-timers, Christie eventually would have an article written about him on Slam Wrestling. It's almost like a rite of passage if you're from a certain era, like a Butcher Vashon. Really, all those guys, Slam Wrestling has something about them. And here's Christie talking about his WWF experience. It was a different world. I had been on top in different places. I was told that I was one of the best workers around as a babyface, but I was getting older. When I went with Vince, I was in my 40s. He gave me a job for a couple months. He didn't give me an opportunity. Resigned to putting others over, Christie spent much of his brief WWF tenure staring up at the lights. It sort of depleted my ego, but a lot of it was my fault because I didn't show him what I had, Christie says. By the same token, I wasn't given a chance. Well, here's his chance right here on Tuesday Night Titans, and he kind of goes insane. There's really no other way of putting it, but let me let him speak for himself.
It's a hot opener.
Well,
Paul, go right ahead and sit down.
No, no, I ain't gonna sit down. Let me explain one thing to you here. First of all, who is Paul Christie, all right? Paul Christie, a wrestler, magician, hypnotist, all right?
All right, I guess people don't know who you are, but I was half expecting him to say that he was a sandwich artist as well. When he walked out, he had this box, and he had a fireball come out of it, which, a little odd to see that, and it kind of spooked both Lord Al and Gene, and he won't sit down on the couch, as is customary. And he has that baton out, and, oh my God.
That would just get your attention, me and Gene.
That's certainly got my attention.
Well,
the box usually does.
Okay, well, you know what, the thing is that, again, that's also get your attention. Let me explain something to you. First of all, the three greatest drives in the world are sex, power, and money. All right?
Do you agree? Not necessarily in that order, but...
First of all, hold on. Motor mouth, please. Listen to me now. Sexually, I'll give you a boo. I'll come here and break your neck, you jerk, you turkey. Sexually, pretty blue eyes. Physically, charming personality. I've got the best. But let's break it right down, all right?
What's in the box?
No, hold on. Let me explain that to you. Okay, hold it. I'll give you what's in the box.
What makes this so insane is that Mean Gene Okerlund, who, in an alternate universe where he goes into theater and improv, could have been on Saturday Night Live or SCTV or one of those shows and probably could have held his own. And he's trying to steer this thing back to be funny. And Christie is just kind of railroading him, which... And you could hear him, the little slur in his voice, in some of the things that he says, like, okay, he might be on something, but hey, this may lead somewhere, it may go off the rails, it may go somewhere interesting, who knows?
Sexually, I have a woman that I want. Pretty blue eyes, physical appearance, charming personality. Right? You got it? Woman, sexual, all right? Financially, how many apartment buildings can you own? How many vacations can you go on, all right? How many apartment buildings? How many shopping centers can you own? I've got it all. I've got 2 out of 3. The only thing I don't have is this. The only thing I don't have is power.
Jesus, this is the worst Jimmy Fallon monologue I've ever heard.
And that's why I decided to call on this program. Power. I want power. Power. I'm going to show you how I'm going to program people's mind, being a hypnotist. Don't be giving us signals over here. Out. I'm taking control. I've got the money. I'm going to buy this whole entire program.
Paul, excuse me. I don't want to be rude, but if you'd be kind enough to sit down, I...
Gene's trying to rein this in before Paul Christie turns into that Chris Berman rant that went viral years ago where he's yelling at the people on staff, like walking around. Christie kind of sounds like Don Cherry when he does the Coach's Corner on Hockey Night in Canada. I know this is another reference that a limited number of you will get. But here's this 85-year-old hockey commentator who for years will not, you know, accept direction from anybody off screen. It's always going to be, you know, his partner Ron McLean there stopping him. Don't signal to me, Paul Christie. Like, clearly he's out of his mind and is acting like a guy who's never been on television before. But Mean Gene's an old pro. So he's going to bring this back in, and out comes Denny Lee. I didn't quite get the name, but it's a magician who I believe was victorious in the 1986 Richard Simmons lookalike contest. And yeah, I know that joke was on WrestleCrap.com as well, but you can't not make that joke looking at the damn guy, because he's got like the exact same like afro hair as Richard Simmons, but the same, you know, amount of layer and texture to it. But the problem is, he comes out and he just kind of sits down. So now this thing is going to continue unabated.
I don't want to sit down.
I've made some special arrangements to have a legitimate magician.
What do you mean legitimate?
Show up.
You're telling me I'm not legitimate? Hey, shake my hand. All right. I'm going to get his attention, right?
You got my attention.
I got your attention. All right, let me do this.
Wait a minute.
What do you mean, wait a minute? I'll tell you right now. I'm going to do this with the audience. I'm going to program their minds, being a hypnotist, and I'm going to tell them how to think. I'm going to take control of the complete entire audience and tell them how to think.
Well, while you're doing that, I'd like to introduce to our audience, to those of you at home here on TNT, magician Denny Lee.
You know about this?
Well, it wouldn't be the last time we have somebody trying hypnosis on the audience. I mean, think of 2014 through 2017 with Roman Reigns and some of the odd situations that he was booked in. I could just picture Vince McMahon. God damn it, pal. We're going to hypnotize the audience into loving Roman Reigns once and for all. Oh, my God. But the guy just comes out and he sits down. So now this allows Christie another opening into this hypnosis thing, which might have been something if he had been like the R-rated hypnotist that used to be in the Boston area, Frank Santos. I'm sure that there are others around the country and around the world. But finally, the only thing that could cut this guy off is when he accidentally makes a dick joke.
I'll go one step beyond, all right? What I have in this box, I'm going to program the audience to think of something, and whatever you think of is in this box. I'm going to program you and make you think of something, and whatever you think of is in this box. All right? Yes, got the message?
Okay.
Hold it. They're going to wind up. I'm here forever. All right?
Lord Alfred.
Wait, hold it.
Hold it.
Don't talk, Lord Alfred. I'm here. Take control. Don't do that to me. You know what? I've got the money. How many vacations can you have? How many Mercedes can you have? How many Cadillacs can you drive? Get that lousy music off here. Will you shut up and these goofy things here? Where's my little thing here?
And there begins and ends the 1986 WWF Attitude Era that nobody remembered. Ha ha ha! He said his dick was small. Ha 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 ha!
Will you shut up?
I meant to ask you about your
little
thing.
He's good. Wait, you to ask me? I programmed you right off the bat. Audience, would you let me talk, Motormouth?
Wait a minute.
Would you let me talk? Wait. You came up here to interview me, right? Made people interested. I'm very charming. I think people can tell. I'm very charming. Type of person. Let's do this now. Audience, I'm going to program your minds. I'm a hypnotist. Will you cut that noise out? I'll wipe this all out. What I'm going to do, audience, I'm going to make you think of something. Reach my pocket. If there's anybody afraid of the unknown, leave the room. What I'm going to do right now, I'm going to program your minds. I'm going to make you think of something. I'm going to make you think of something, and Wrestler Supreme, I decided, check your calendars, your dates, whatever it may be, I am never going to lose a match. Never. Did you ever see hypnotist? Did you ever see a man go mad? Actually go mad? I mean, don't give me these slow signals. I'm going to buy this whole entire studio. Hey, I'm not too ignorant.
Paul Christie.
Motor mouth.
Paul Christie, in all due respect,
I'm going to show you about it.
Not a bad idea, perhaps,
all due respect.
Stick to wrestling.
Like I said in the intro, they were throwing a lot of weird stuff at the wall and were trying to see what was going to stick. Maybe this didn't. I don't know. But I still enjoyed it a hell of a lot more than pretty much every Dolph Ziggler match I've ever watched.
Be warned. Be ready. Beware. Schwarzenegger got a raw deal, and now he means business.
I thought I might get lucky. And now, it's your turn.
Raw Deal, rated R, starts Friday, June 6th at theaters everywhere.
That was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie to forget, Raw Deal, which is not to be confused with SmackDown Deal, which is a movie that doesn't exist. But anyway, not the last time you'd have a plug for a Arnold Schwarzenegger movie that bombed on WWF television. I remember him showing up in like 1999, be like, come see my movie, End of Days. The interesting part of that movie is the producer or the distributor actually wanted to make Total Recall and did this movie so that he could maybe make enough money to make Total Recall, which was a movie later with Arnold Schwarzenegger, but he had to file for bankruptcy, sold the rights to Total Recall to somebody else. He had wanted to cast Patrick Swayze in this, what became the Schwarzenegger role. So, kind of an interesting backstory to that one. Another ad for Old Spice, and one for the new Newlywed Game, and they kind of show this one bickering couple, which is kind of funny.
Hi there, I'm Bob Eubanks. You know, once in a while, our couples may have a slight disagreement. True. Now that she has a big mouth.
Well, hell, I knew that when I met you.
Roger. Roger, I want you to sit up real straight. That's it. Now look at her right in the eye and say, Gerald, I'm the boss.
Not to reference her again, but in that ad for the Newlywed Game, the woman had the same hairstyle as Maggie O'Hooligan from Caddyshack. She keeps coming up here. And then there's a final ad for a long-forgotten game show. In fact, I don't remember this at all, called A Chance of a Lifetime, which aired from January of 1986 through September of 1987. To sum up, it was a hangman-style game, but with rules that were a bit more confusing than that of Wheel of Fortune. Now, I say that with my wife reporting to me that my father-in-law said that he doesn't, quote, understand the concept of Wheel of Fortune, but I guess that's his own deal. The final round of Chance of a Lifetime is more similar to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, in that you keep going up money levels and you can quit at a certain point. So you could win $10,000 and walk away, but $1 million was the final prize. Since every time I get a show that has commercials on it, I tend to go a little bit too long, why don't I go to the final bout, which is the return of Harley Race to the World Wrestling Federation after a 6-year absence. As I mentioned earlier, he was there in 1980 to defend the NWA title against Bob Backlund at Madison Square Garden. He is taking on SD Jones at Maple Leaf Gardens, which was taped on May 4th. So only a couple of weeks after he was in the AWA wrestling on the Wrestle Rock show at the Hubert H. Humphrey Metrodome, or the Triple H Metrodome, if you really want to call it that. It's kind of an odd opponent for Harley to start off with, but the original choice, Tony Garea, well, you can't have Harley Race versus Tony Garea because they wear the exact same trunks, and you don't want to have that Backlund Valentine thing from 81 where the ref gets confused and counts the wrong guy down. Now, Harley, of course, was the NWA champion for a very long time, from the mid-70s up through Starrcade 83, with, you know, losing the title here and there, but when you have 7 reigns, 8 if you include that weird Pacific Islands Australia one from 1984, that switch with Ric Flair. Ever since Starrcade 83, he had been mostly homesteading in the Kansas City promotion, also working in St. Louis as well, but had been doing a lot of tours of All Japan Pro Wrestling, and that is where he was very early in 1986. And as the story goes, on March 20th of that year, 86, Harley goes to a WWF show, not as a fan, but as a general crazy person. And this is a show in Kansas City. Harley is pissed off that they have invaded his territory, so he hits Hulk Hogan in the ribs, per the account of the history of WWE.com, Graham Cawthon's site. Now, whether it was the gun, I've heard the story of like Harley pulled the gun and all that, but really, the funniest part of all of that is that he gets a job with the company so soon after that happened. Such is the credibility of Harley Race that he could pull something like that and, it doesn't matter. Come on in and make some money with us. You'll draw somebody with Hogan in 87 in the Garden. In his early run, he's not known as the King. In fact, he isn't even always known as Handsome, as here he's just being called Harley Race. He does eventually wrestle in Kansas City. That was one of the things I really wanted to look for. In July of 86, there's no results for that, but that is prior to his coronation, which a lot of people have an issue with Harley Race wearing the goofy-looking crown. I think that's more of a mistake on the costuming rather than Harley Race himself looking goofy. I do think that they needed to give him a little bit of something because I'm not sure how the WWF audience, given how they've been trained, how they've been molded over the past couple of years, how they were going to react to somebody like Harley Race, who's very slow and deliberate in the ring. And we're going to see that in this match as we start out SD with a little bit of offense, hip toss, and a side headlock takeover. And immediately, because this is 1986 WWF and we are in Toronto Bizarro Land, we get a boring chant right off the start. Now, can't they show a little damn respect for Harley Race, a former NWA champion who presumably would go up to Toronto and defend his title at Maple Leaf Gardens back when the NWA had a foothold in that city? Ugh, I'm really annoyed at whoever's chanting boring that early into a match. Could you at least give it a chance to be boring before you start criticizing it? Big high knee by Harley Race as a young Paul Levesque somewhere smiles and nods in approval as Heenan and Gorilla are, once again, they're doing this match. This would actually air on Primetime Wrestling, but not until July. I always like when on Primetime they would air matches like months and months later. I think there's one match from MSG that was taped in like early 85 that didn't air until close to the fall of 86. Very strange how they would hold stuff like that. So anyway, the Brain and Gorilla are discussing traveling to the Eastern Bloc and all the countries they've been to under the guise of talking about SD's move to Antigua and the West Indies. As Harley is ramping up the offense and he hits the Harley Race pile driver where he slowly comes back with it, but SD kicks out at two. Again, very deliberate, but Heenan watching Harley, and you can tell from his commentary that he's making it clear that he's very familiar with his body of work, and he likes it.
And you know what I love about watching Harley Race wrestle? He never gets in there like Santana did and starts off with a blast of fire. He enjoys, he's meticulous. He enjoys his work. He takes his time. He wounds a man. He wears himself.
Methodical is the word you're looking for. Is that not it?
Oh, you did. Okay,
I didn't hear you.
Heenan and Monsoon still kind of working out their bit together on commentary. Harley Race coming in to the WWF, the person he's probably most similar to who is a WWF mainstay is Greg Valentine. Now, clearly, Race is a bigger star than Greg Valentine, but I can definitely see Gorilla Monsoon saying kind of the same stuff, like, oh, it takes 15 minutes for Harley Race to get warmed up, just from the way he works, very deliberate, working on a body part. Greg Valentine would work on the leg to set up the figure four. Harley Race hit the pile driver, so now he goes to work on the neck, hitting a neck breaker. But SD kicks out at one. This is a very strange match. And then Harley's like, you know what? I'm just going to start throwing bombs here because I come from All Japan. I'm not going to dump you on your head, but I am going to hit a gut-wrench suplex for two. As Gorilla points out, he's hit three finisher-type moves on SD and hasn't put him away. A vertical suplex, that gets a two count. An elbow, that also gets a two count. And finally, after all this rigmarole of SD kicking out of all these finisher-type moves, he finally fires up, but then he gets poked in the eye by Harley, who hits a headbutt, which it works for him for some reason. Nobody else can headbutt SD Jones, but for Harley Race, he can do that, even from the second rope, which by the way, gets a two count. It's like, what is going on? Like, what is this leading to? Well, it's leading to SD Jones hitting three headbutts of his own, the one where he kind of jumps up in the air and comes down with it. It's interesting when you have two guys hitting headbutts on each other, and it seems to have an effect on the other guy. Usually they'll play that hard head card, which is, you know, kind of racist, but it is 1986. A race catches SD Jones in the boiler, as Bob Uecker would say. It hits him with a power slam and gets the 1-2-3. A very odd beginning for Harley Race, although some would say dressing him up like the cartoon king from the Brady Bunch was odd as well. But I've always kind of felt that you needed a little something for him to kind of stand out in that cartoonish WWF universe. And at least it's an acknowledgement of his past. And it's kind of funny because I seem to recall saying the exact same stuff about Harley in the first match of the first episode I ever did of Greetings from Allentown. It was Harley Race versus a fellow by the name of Mike Kelly, who would go on to become Shane Douglas and reference Harley Race in throwing down the NWA title in 1994.
Harpel Kirshner and those other two pencil-neck geeks, the English Bulldogs.
I
don't care. English, British, it's all the same.
No, Freddie, they're not all the same, because you got England, you got Scotland, you got Wales, you got the other ones that are slipping my mind because it's a very late hour and I've been drinking bourbon. I mean, I'm kind of surprised to hear that out of Freddie Blassie, a man who has managed wrestlers from all over the world, whether they be from Inner Mongolia, Iran, Russia, and Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik are with them. And Nikolai Volkoff, I'm just kind of thinking here as he gets to speak for a brief period. What is the best Nikolai Volkoff promo of all time? I'll ponder that while he says his piece.
We never lost those battles ours, and we proved it a second time after we met British Bulldog. We beat them the first fall. The only supposed to be one fall. But a slimy Lou Albano, he was very quick.
Well, I think that's the only time anybody has ever referred to Captain Lou Albano as quick. The best Volkoff promo ever is clearly the one from the summer of 1990 where he says, Hacksaw Jim Duggan is my hero. That just for him saying that line, that makes it the best Nikolai Volkoff promo of all time. But Cheeky Baby is there, and the best part is while you get the normal Iron Sheik insanity, Freddie Blassie is standing in the background because he has this magazine/newspaper where the Iron Sheik is on the back cover, and he's just holding it up like a hostage, holding up that day's newspaper to show that he is being treated well and is doing okay.
Listen, you intelligent American, you make it to the WWF toughest, roughest area in the world. That way I respect you.
Thank you very much.
But I want to ask you, intelligent American, can you tell me who was the WWF champion before Hulk Hogan?
You were.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, can you tell me who made the Mr. Blassie to be tag team also champion? You know who was before that English Bulldog?
British Bulldogs, but that was Greg the Hammer Valentine, Brutus Beefcake.
How about before that? Right. How about before that?
Well, sometime back, you and Nikolai...
Just a minute. Who was before them?
Sometime back, you and Nikolai Volkoff.
Not sometime. For sure, Mr. Blassie makes the Iron Sheik to be world-class man and also tag team world-class man. Now, English Bulldog.
I'm sorry, Iron Sheik.
I think it's funny that they interrupt the Iron Sheik's promo with that particular Robert Palmer song. Although I would change a few lyrics to make it about the Iron Sheik. Might as well face it, you're addicted to coke. Might as well face it, you're addicted to coke. All right, enough singing for one show as they throw it to commercial for the nighttime Price is Right airing on that channel in Sacramento. This is not the normal daytime version hosted by Bob Barker. This is the nighttime version hosted by Tom Kennedy. And the show ended its run on May 30th, 1986. So this is right when it was ending. I don't even remember watching the Nighttime Price is Right. However, I remember that one weird season where Bob Barker just showed up and his hair was all gray. Like, you'd watched him the previous Friday and his hair was black. And then he comes in the following Monday and it's all gray. And I remember being 7, 8 years old and it just threw me for a friggin' loop. But then, as it turned out, he was a sexual predator behind the scenes. Probably. And he beat up Happy Gilmore, so he probably should have been arrested for assault. Another ad for the Cal Expo. All right, fine. I'll go. If only to see a guy cut through a VCR with a chainsaw, rent a center. And finally, an ad for the People's Court, which was going by the slogan, Undeniably Real. A interesting choice of slogan to be advertising on a wrestling show. And People's Court was real small claims court cases. This was not all kayfabe BS, like a show like The Judge that you would see. I think that was on the USA Network, which is about a guy who was a judge, and they would show court cases in the same vein as the People's Court. But it was all storyline, like when the dude pulled a gun or took the bailiff's gun and held everybody hostage. That was the most memorable episode of that. And I've probably referenced it on this podcast before. I mean, I've done 115 episodes, and I would certainly bring that up at some point. The People's Court, also, I consider partly responsible for the rise of Harvey Levin, because I remember watching it in college, and he was the courtside reporter, so to speak. He was the one who would interview people just outside the courtroom when things were over. Promotional consideration by Stetson Cologne, which it would have been great if Lord Al had been like, Stetson Cologne, get some pussy while you're on the road. Promotional consideration also presented by Rent-A-Wreck, which would do the exact opposite of the Stetson Cologne. Liquid Plumber and Diet 7-Up, not Diet Cherry 7-Up, which exploded in my freezer all those many years ago. As Lord Al and Vince wrap up this week's show and tell us that next week, Mean Gene Okerlund will be hosting in Vince McMahon's place, and that we'll be seeing the Killer Bees. So thank God I didn't get a request to do that show. And Harley Race will be in the flower shop with Adrian Adonis, which props a great laugh from Lord Al. Oh, I can't wait to see Harley in the flower shop. So that should be a lot of fun. And that'll do it for the WWF Superstars of Wrestling, the D Show, from May 31st, 1986. And elsewhere in podcast land, the return of the sportscasters late last week. Two big episodes, one with Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, who covers the National Hockey League, and he didn't say anything bad about Boston, so I got no problem with that interview. But later on in the weekend, I believe he released it on Sunday, he had Joe Buck of Fox Sports on, and it was particularly interesting when Joe Buck explains why he loves hockey and why he loves the St. Louis Blues. And I'm sure he was watching last night on Wednesday, game 3 of the Western Conference Finals, as the Blues got totally screwed by a referee missing an obvious hand pass where a goal is scored by San Jose moments later. On the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn, they wrap up their WrestleMania Flush series of the 10 worst WrestleManias. And I am disappointed in them, or more accurately, I'm disappointed in the nominators of the worst WrestleManias, because WrestleMania 31 did not make it onto that list. How is that even possible? That show was a 6-hour-long abortion to the point where 6 separate southern states has signed legislation to outlaw WrestleMania 31 from ever being shown in their territory ever again. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis, they go back into the archives, because once upon a time, they did shows on Monday and Thursday, but apparently not everybody was listening to the Thursday show back in the day on BDA Radio. So they talk about some of their worst moments in wrestling, their worst matches, the worst things that they were ever booked or were part of. And I like those ones. Those are always fun. And they're talking about the silly crap that's happened in their careers. So do check that out. And be sure to give Greetings from Allentown a 5-star review on Apple Music, iTunes, whatever the hell it's called this week. And do tell a friend about Greetings from Allentown, this wacky, wonderful show where I talk about baseball, 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 and have a few thoughts on wrestling in between, where I recycled the same Harley Race take in episode 115 that I may have said in episode 1. But hey, We all evolve. Watching wrestling is a journey. I feel differently now than I did in 2017, than I felt in 2015. And sure, it's a hell of a lot different than I felt watching wrestling in 1998 and 99, especially 99, because the stuff that I watched religiously every Monday on the USA Network, I can barely even tolerate that now. Now, as for next week's show, I was tossing around a couple of different things. And I got to just do this already because I've been pushing back this show for a very long time. NWA Pro Wrestling, February 21st, 1987. Jimmy Cornette has an issue with Ronnie Garvin. How is he going to solve that issue? By throwing a fucking fireball in his face. And this leads to consequences for Jimmy Garvin and others as well. So a very interesting show that I've had in my queue. And it's high time that I finally get to that. And coming soon, I'm going to do a Portland episode, Portland Wrestling from 1980. I also have a WWF show from 1980 that has a rather infamous Bob Backlund match, which... I'm just going to leave it at that. He is facing a mysterious masked man and a whole host of other stuff I have in the pipeline. A lot of WWF shows from the early 80s that I've kind of gotten away from doing stuff from like 81 and 82. So I need to go back to that early 80s period where Joe McHugh was giving the shout outs to the Pennsylvania State Athletic Commission. Thank you so much for listening, and do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Where's my little thing here?